Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FedSoc Forums. My name is Riley Revilla, and I am a student at Georgetown University. I also serve as the student liaison to the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of our speakers and not of the Federalist Society, as the Federalist Society takes no positions. Today's program is titled Litigation Update, International Partners for Ethical Care versus Ferguson. We're very pleased to welcome an excellent group of panelists. Sean Gunnarsson is a shareholder with Curtin McConkie in Salt Lake City. He's a member of the firm's Appellate, International, and First Amendment and Religious Organizations sections. Before joining Curtin McConkie, he served as senior counsel to U.S. Senator Robert F. Bennett, worked as an associate for the Washington, D.C. office of White & Case, and litigated for the Washington Legal Foundation. Derek Muller is a professor of law at Notre Dame Law School. He is a nationally recognized scholar in the field of election law. His research focuses on the role of states in the administration of federal elections, the constitutional contours of voting rights and election administration, the limits of judicial power in the domain of elections, and the Electoral College. Professor Muller has published more than 24 academic works, and his op-eds have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Wall Street Journal. Our moderator is Teresa Collette, who is a professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, where she serves as director of the school's Pro-Life Center. Professor Collette has published numerous legal articles and is the co-author of a law casebook on professional responsibility and co-editor of a collection of essays exploring Catholic perspectives on American law. She's an elected member of the American Law Institute and has testified before committees of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, as well as before legislative committees in several states. In 2009, Pope Benedict XVI appointed her to a 5-year term on the Pontifical Council for the Family. One note for our audience before we begin. If you have any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen, not the chat, so that we'll be able to access them later in the program. With that note, I will turn things over to our speakers to start the conversation. Professor Collette, thank you so much for joining us and for moderating today's discussion.
Thank you, Riley. This is a very interesting case, and it will be conferenced yet again later this week. And so I'd like to invite Sean to sort of set us up with the petitioner's perspective of the case. What is the cert petition seeking, and how do you assess the arguments that they're making?
Well, thank you, Teresa. Very little bit of background here, just to make sure we set the table for everyone. This case involves a couple of Washington statutes that essentially rewrite the terms on which state-sponsored or state-licensed runaway shelters operate. And it does it in a couple of ways. First off, it will essentially instruct these shelters to provide what the statute calls gender-affirming care, which can essentially is undefined. It can range from mental health interventions and perhaps even medical interventions. It's unclear. The second thing that it does is lay out a kind of timeline by which these shelters will inform parents that their runaway child has arrived at a shelter that will be providing such care. The petitioners raised a variety of claims ranging from free exercise to due process claims. And I want to focus on what the Ninth Circuit said about those claims, because that sets us up for the Supreme Court. Interestingly enough, the Ninth Circuit panel unanimously concluded that there was no standing in the case. That is, that the petitioners in particular lacked injury in fact, which you'll recall is one of the three essential elements of showing Article III standing. There were a variety of reasons that the Ninth Circuit cited, but I want to focus on a couple of them. First off is that the Ninth Circuit rejected the idea that the parents could show a current injury in fact. That is, that the parents argued a couple of things. First off, they said that their current parenting styles were directly impacted by these laws. Essentially, the laws disincentivize parents who oppose their children's gender transitioning. So conversations ranging from the use of personal pronouns to cross-dressing and all the rest of it were, in their minds, heavily influenced by the prospect of encouraging their children to run away and get the gender transition care the children are looking for. The second thing, of course, is closely related, which is a free speech claim that the parents are essentially having to self-censor in their conversations with their children because of these laws. And the court on those present-oriented claims essentially said there cannot be an injury from essentially a self-injury. And on this point, the court cited a Supreme Court precedent called Clapper, which I'll come back to or hear in a little bit. On the other future-looking injury, that is, the prospect of losing physical custody of your children because of the incentive that the state law puts out, and also the notion that any kind of information about their children's whereabouts would be interfered with by the state. On those grounds as well, the Ninth Circuit simply held that the parents had failed to show an injury in fact, because in the court's view, the parents had nowhere claimed that there was a particular child who had either asserted a desire for gender transitioning care or who threatened to run away in order to take advantage of the state's laws. From this, the petitioners then filed a cert petition earlier in the year, which, by the way, attracted some 20 amicus briefs. Now, I have to tell you, after decades of practice in the Supreme Court, that is an unusually high number. I litigate quite frequently in First Amendment and related areas, and we're doing pretty well on a petition if we see four or five supporting amicus briefs. This had, a monumental number for the petition stage. The question presented, which I'm actually going to read out here because I think it's important for us to keep focused on what the petitioners are asking, is, quote, whether parents have standing to challenge a law or policy that deliberately displaces their decision-making role as to gender transitions of their children, and in so doing creates present and likely future impediments to their ability to parent their children as they deem best for them. Now, in the petitioner's view, there are a couple or three important considerations here. Now, and number one, that Article III standing is not supposed to be a barrier to vindicating constitutional rights, that the court, in fact, tends to relax standing requirements when rights under the First Amendment and other provisions are involved. And the petitioner's side, a number of decisions to that extent. But I think probably the most important line of argument that the petitioners identify, which connects up with a couple of things that the court itself has said, comes out in the reply. And the reason for that timing is very simply this. Supreme Court just a couple of months ago issued a case called Mirabilia versus Bonta. And in that case, in a closely related issue area, the court issued an emergency lifting a stay, an injunction lifting the stay that had been imposed by the Ninth Circuit in a case involving a statewide school district policy in California that requires school districts to conceal from parents the gender transitioning activities of their children in public school. And the court said several things in the course of Mirabilia, but I want to focus on a couple. The first thing it said quite emphatically was that these parents had suffered an irreparable harm, and that the irreparable harm would, in fact, be furthered if required to litigate before they could get protection from this particular law. And that was particularly as to the free exercise claimants, although also with respect to simply due process claims with the general right of parents. The second thing, which I found quite interesting, is that right, that injury that they identify, is not tied to any particular claim that the individual parents had children at this moment, that they had proof of gender transitioning in school. or that the parents could point to a particular interaction with the school where they've later found out that the school had concealed such information from the parents. That is, the very fact that the law would, in a common sense way, lead to those results was enough for the court to say that the California law irreparably injured the parents, and therefore an injunction lifting the Ninth Circuit stay was justified. In light of that, and maybe coming to the end of my table setting here, in light of that Mirabelli decision and its reasoning, and in particular the concurrence by the Chief Justice Barrett and Kavanaugh underscoring the continuing importance of the due process rights in cases like Meyer and Pierce and others that we're all familiar with, I think that the Supreme Court's most recent statement on standing and parental rights is quite jarring in comparison with where the Ninth Circuit came out on the question of standing in this case. And so for my mind, I do hope that the court grants review to visit the issue of standing in this area.
Now, Derek, my recollection is that the Mirabelli was a case involved a per curiam order. And in fact, there was quite a perhaps heated is too strong, but exchange between Justice Barrett and one of the other justices about whether or not this was an appropriate way to dispose of the case. And so how does that affect the state of Washington's claims that cert should not be granted in this case? Is Mirabelli that strong a precedent for it?
Right.
Go ahead, Derek.
No. I appreciate it. Yeah, there's a lot of standing decisions that keep churning around the Supreme Court with increasingly fine distinctions at times between the cases and the facts and the record below. And I think it really indicates the importance of the factual development of the record and trying to make sure that you have the strongest plaintiffs or petitioners on the claim with the strongest kind of record possible. In a case like Mirabelli, I think, especially in Justice Barrett writing separately, that the record shows that there was this non-disclosure policy in the school. It clearly applies even if parents expressly ask for the information. Some of them learned only after a suicide attempt of one of the children, right? I mean, you had a pretty robust record there of how this policy would affect parental rights in that particular school. And there's still a dispute. There's a dispute on the merits in addition to a dispute maybe on the standing issue. But a lot of the Mirabelli decision seemed to be fighting a lot more about the merits, about how naturally cases like Mahmoud extend to cases like Mirabelli and what might be there. But this is one of these cases. Again, while I do a lot of election law, I also have a federal courts case book, and increasingly a lot of election law is just federal courts litigation. And increasingly a lot of these, gender identity cases seem to be wrapped up in standing, much maybe as a generation ago, a lot of civil liberties or environmental cases were really just a lot of standing, a lot of federal courts disputes. I mean, this case is hard for the petitioners. I mean, they lost the Ninth Circuit, and they got a few justices or judges dissenting en banc at the Ninth Circuit. But I think that there's a strong notion that in these cases, there are just a lot of contingencies that have to arise. So as I read this petition, again, I'm very sympathetic to the parents in this case on the merits. There's a separate question about the standing. As I read the introduction of the petition, it includes these caveats. Parents can be kept into the dark as to the child's location and condition. Reunification can be significantly delayed. And even in that opening paragraph of your introduction of why cert should be granted, this can language keeps cropping up to suggest that there's going to be some hesitation and some contingencies that are going to arise in these cases. Now, a couple of years ago, in a case called, I might get the titles wrong because it's again, not the core of my parents protecting our children, Justice Alito dissented from the denial of cert in a similarly situated case, joined by Justice Thomas. And Justice Alito wrote separately to say, look, I think some of our precedents are being misinterpreted by the lower courts, called a questionable understanding. and said, you know, I think the lower courts have gotten our decision in Clapper versus Amnesty International wrong on standing issues, and we need to revisit this. And I feel a little bit like Justice Alito is the guy in the hot dog costume, sort of the meme that happens online. We're all looking for the guy who did this. I mean, Justice Alito wrote Clapper versus Amnesty International in 2013, and he had a pretty strong view on standing and how difficult it ought to be in some cases about those contingencies that would arise in a case like this. And to highlight, I think, why the Ninth Circuit dispatched of this case, right? It's in the abstract, we can say it's a parental rights case. But when you look at what has to happen in a case like this, there has to be a child who runs away. And the child has to run away, at least in part, because of some concerns about gender dysphoria. And the child has to then run away to a licensed shelter in the state of Washington, because that's what's regulated by this activity. And then the state has to evaluate that child and conclude that the child is suffering gender dysphoria, that medical treatment is necessary for this child. And then not only that medical treatment is necessary, that then there's a compelling interest in failing to communicate that or delay that communication to parents. That is a long series of things that have to happen. And when you read the court's precedents on standing and using that language of imminent, that there has to be some kind of imminent injury, right? Something that has to happen that is certainly impending in the language of Clapper versus Amnesty International. Building up all of those sort of future contingencies just is unlikely in a case like this, and especially when the state of Washington is going to say, look, I mean, there are some situations where we're going to notify the parents and others where we aren't, and we have to identify that this is a context-specific, fact-dependent set of circumstances. I kind of close on this. You know, I think the parents, you know, again, understandably, are going to say, listen, because of these laws, maybe I'm going to change my behavior. I'm going to react in certain ways. That's the same kind of claims that were made in Clapper versus Amnesty International. Look, the chance is that I might have my phones tapped by the federal government. So I'm taking precautions or I'm changing my behavior in certain ways. And the court's approach in Clapper is to say, if that's not a future harm, you can't sort of say then that there is this change in your conduct that creates the present harm. There has to be some sort of linkage between those two things. And so just because you're overly fearful of what might happen, you know, that over fearfulness is on a bunch of contingencies that we don't think are sufficiently imminent. And therefore, that sort of present harm is just something you've manufactured in this current case. So again, a lot of sympathy for the parents and their concerns here about those future cases that might arise. But I think there's a reason why the court has been reluctant to grant some of these cases in the past, and maybe why there might be difficulty or reluctance in granting it in this case.
John, given Derek's explanation of Clapper, the petition also notes that Washington State has a minor consent law that allows any minor over 13 to consent to mental health care without and exclude the parents from knowledge of that. That seems a much more direct law that will affect every parent in the state of Washington whose child seeks or who is encouraged to seek through schools, et cetera, this sort of mental health. Is that the stronger claim in the complaint? It's preserved. I think it's preserved because it's raised at the intermediate, at the Ninth Circuit. It's also raised in the cert petition. Is that a stronger case for direct standing in this case?
Well, it's certainly an additional one. I wouldn't say that it's stronger. So I'm going to respond to Derek's point on it with a couple of things. First off, I think that it's important to note, as he rightly points out, that Justice Alito was the author of Clapper. It was one of the central decisions relied on by the Ninth Circuit panel. But Justice Alito, in these two separate opinions on a denial of certiorari, points out that in his view, and his view shared by, you know, two other justices in those settings, that standing doctrine has been misapplied in these gender-related cases. Now, exactly what the calculus of that is, but for all of those who follow the court, you know that the rule of four says they were one justice away from getting a grant in that case. So it's maybe good to pay attention to that. The other thing is there is a case that was decided just last year that does not involve these very controversial areas, but rather sort of just straight out standing decision called the Diamond Alternative Energy case. And in that case, the court dealt with the California policy that basically discouraged oil and gas production, told car producers, you got to start putting out more EV vehicles. And oil producers who were not directly named in the statute brought a lawsuit challenging the legality of that. And the only question before the court was standing. And the court really did not have a difficult time concluding, and again, just sort of limiting ourselves to injury in fact, that these gas producers who were not named in the statute nonetheless suffer an injury in fact when the state enacts a regulation that but hits their bottom line. Now, in this case, if you start from the premise, which I start from, which is sort of the Parham case, probably the clearest case of for parental rights in this area, where the court has repeatedly stressed that parents hold a constitutional right to make medical decisions for their children. When Washington essentially overrides that decision-making process, it isn't any longer sort of an administration of state facilities kind of a law. And if you read the record and sort of the legislative statements by various lawmakers, it was specifically and directly intended to override the wishes of parents who object to their children's gender transitioning. So in my mind, it's not a theoretical somewhere in the distance possible, the house that Jack built kind of contingency. This will happen for any family whose child decides to run away. If they're running away for the reason of getting gender transition care, this law comes into an effect. And at least as I understand Diamond and some of the other court standing decisions, that should be enough for an Article III court to hear the merits.
But didn't Parham involve a situation that was the case where the court confronted a parent committing a child with the doctor's consultation for institutionalization for mental health treatment? And there you had agreement between the medical community and the parents as to the proper treatment for the child. And the court stressed, as I recall, in the majority opinion, that medical evaluation would be reviewed, if not on a monthly basis, it would be reviewed frequently, and that there might be a case where the parents and medical authorities disagreed. Is it really that applicable to this case where at least the state of Washington presumes a transgender child would both be seeking transitioning and that medical professionals would agree and provide that treatment?
Well, I'm going to slightly disagree with you on one point, Teresa, and that is I don't read Parham for the proposition that medical expertise overrides a parent's decision making. I think that the court stressed that the constitutional baseline was parental decision making and simply pointed to that cooperation with, collaboration with medical advice as an additional reason to defer to the parent's decision making in that case. But I see Parham, and I guess I see the way that it was cited in the Mirabelli decision as well, particularly in the Barrett concurrence, as sort of one of our foundation stones in the area of parental rights. And for that reason, I don't see it really qualified by the proposition that, well, the medical community can simply override parents' wishes. Obviously, they can in extreme circumstances. The parents pose a physical threat of safety or anything like that to the child. I'm not talking about the extreme cases like, the blood transfusion cases, say, and so on. But in these cases that are controversial, even within the medical community, it's hard to say that the state has chosen the right course by simply overriding the wishes of parents anytime that they oppose a child's gender transition.
Derek, how do you evaluate the fact that the plaintiffs argue accurately that at least three justices have specifically said this is an urgent question, this treatment of transgenderism without parental authority is an urgent question to be decided, as well as a fourth justice would have granted cert, as the petitioners put it? You've got your four. Why Is this a good vehicle for a resolution of this conflict between either the medical community or the state community legislature and parents' right to direct the care and well-being of their children?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things to think about here. One is sort of a meta question about, you know, the cert worthiness of some of these cases. But that's also, I mean, in my mind, somewhat separate from that Article 3 question. And if it's an Article 3 issue, regardless of whether it's big or small, it's supposed to be, is there jurisdiction, is there not jurisdiction? And it doesn't really matter the size of the case or the impact that it might have on the economy or population or whatever it might be. So I get a little uncomfortable, especially when Justice Alito in the parents' decision sort of suggests that that courts are kind of ducking this issue or ducking transgender issues. I mean, we can think about, again, Mirabelli is one, Mahmoud is another, sort of the other side, West Virginia versus BPG, and Scrimeti. I mean, these transgender issues are being litigated in the courts and they're coming up to the Supreme Court. So we can ask ourselves about whether or not the timing is sort of adequate or appropriate or how much there's cert worthiness under Rule 10 for the Supreme Court to grant these issues. But again, I think thinking about the standing issue should be, in my judgment, a separate kind of question about whether or not there's an injury in fact, fairly traceable to the conduct of the defendant and redressable by the court. Again, in these cases, there are just so many contingencies. It's not just, again, at one level of abstraction, we can say it's about parents' interests in supervising the medical care and decisions of their children. But again, in this case, there's a lot of narrowness and a lot of contingencies that have to arise. Again, when I read the text of the statute, it's finding that there's reasonable grounds to believe that removal is necessary to prevent imminent physical harm due to abuse or neglect. And the release of information will cause severe psychological or physical harm to the juvenile. So there's a lot of contingencies baked into that statute, adverbs and adjectives in context-specific inquiries, to sort of take a step back and ask, you know, is this the kind of case to speak as a blanket policy that would be appropriate, especially given child has to run away to the licensed shelter to be evaluated by the state in such contingencies and to meet these sort of qualifications in the statute. So again, the court at various times seems comfortable with what we might label facial challenges to statutes as opposed to as applied at a high level of abstraction versus a very narrow one. But I think there's going to be a reason why the justices have in the past been reluctant to hear these cases. It's because they don't have these specific parents who are showing up with these sort of specific concerns, like some of the other ones in cases like Mahmoud, where the parents know that this is the curriculum that their children are experiencing in this classroom, that there's some of that much more specific linkage. While it's a blanket policy, clearly happening in this particular school district with these children under this curriculum that's prescribed by the school. And I'm just wondering how much of that gap is going to matter when it comes up in front of the Supreme Court this week.
John, I see you nodding your head.
Well, I'm just following along, and I'm sure Derek already knows this, but I'm smiling a little because, of course, the Fourth Circuit disagreed and found no standing for the folks in Mahmoud, despite the fact that they pointed to all of these details on a fairly hefty record. This is not at all exact, and I absolutely agree with Derek that the merits in the Article III question have to be teased apart. But there is sort of from a meta perspective, a sense in which the court is both careful to apply Article III requirements in a way that it wouldn't have done, you know, say 30 years ago. But it's also, I think, increasingly mindful that the stakes in a case matter, that, you know, pre-enforcement challenges like 303 Creative from Colorado a couple of years ago matter because the stakes are that high. And so even though I think theoretically and logically we can tease these apart, I think the scale of perceived threat and risk to parental rights is great enough in this case to certainly get the justices' attention.
One of the points made in Mahmoud was that in that particular case, the school district had allowed an opt-out for a few years at least once they instituted this policy of requiring this curriculum. And then with very little notice and with very little explanation, they suddenly reversed course and said, nope, you can't opt out anymore. We're done. It doesn't matter. It's too hard to administer, et cetera, et cetera. In this case, we see a similar sort of significant legislative shift, it seems to me, in the record, in that they, state of Washington, initially, as I understand the record, required that when a runaway came to a shelter or even a family member, initially, they had to report to the parents that that this child had come and they were safe and here's where they were, and then sort out whether or not the child should be returned, et cetera. And with the transgender issue, the plaintiffs make much of the fact that they are equating parents who believe that the child should be raised in accordance with their biological sex, and that any transitory feelings of being in the wrong body will fade during adolescence, a finding of the CAS study over in England. They suddenly decide, no, parents who object to transitioning transgender children are the equivalent of abusive parents. Is that sort of legislative shift in the notice requirement significant as it was in Mahmoud? Or did you see that being significant in Mahmoud?
It certainly was significant in Mahmoud. It was some indirect evidence that something unusual was happening for Montgomery County, that it wasn't simply applying pre-existing rules to parents who objected on these grounds, that they had sort of singled out some procedural barrier for this particular curriculum program that they didn't really interpose for anything else. In Washington, comes from a parent who once lost track of a child in a bookstore for all of 45 minutes. The notion of being unaware of where your child is for up to 10 days, I have to say, is the single fact in this case that sort of riveted my attention. You could have disputes with experts, you can have conversations with folks at a state licensing center, but to not know where your child is for up to 10 days because the child doesn't want you to know, that's kind of tough.
Derek, do you think it's significant that there appear to be fairly substantial amendments to the original statute regarding runaway children and notification to parents?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think as Sean mentioned, part of this is there's some contingencies built in here, right? And I'm not nearly as steeped in the record as maybe both of you are. But as I see it, right, there are some of these things do require some efforts to contact the parents. And then there are these questions about if or if known or what kinds of thing, what happens if the minor withholds the information from the parents, what kinds of independent efforts does the Department for Children have to engage in to go find these things. So again, those are all sort of these additional baked in layers that I think, you know, add some of that complexity if we're thinking about the imminent injury to parents in these cases, not just running away. It's also sort of failing to meet some of these additional things that at least they're on the surface to some cursory level require some degree of effort to be made to notify the parents, along with on the flip side, some and adjectives and adverbs about contingencies in which notice would not be given or would be inappropriate, and trying to figure out what are those circumstances where maybe they've made a judgment that that inappropriately burdens parental rights in these cases, because Sean admits in certain extreme cases, we would say, of course, the state should be able to protect the children in those situations of obvious abuse. But it's in those cases where we're sort of in this middle ground of just mere disagreement with the method of supervising children who are undergoing gender dysphoria. You know, if the parents are overly assuming that that's what the conduct of the state is going to regulate their behavior, if they're thinking that there's too much of this fearful behavior and reaction to things that may never come to fruition, and that's the question about whether or not the court is going to be interested in thinking about that sort of speculative harm. Again, for some like Justice Alito, and understandably, in some circumstances, I think Sean's right, the magnitude of the rights that are at stake have led the court to sort of relax some of these principles and say, at a general level, we're concerned enough, we're going to dig in. But again, the more of these contingencies you bake into a statutory scheme, or the more questions that arise about the likelihood that it would ever come to pass in a way that would actually burden the underlying constitutional right, the more questions I think there are going to be about whether or not the petitioners are going to be able to establish standing in a case like this.
So, Derek, this may be an unfair question, but
what are these webinars for, if not the occasional unfair question?
Give me a fact pattern that would satisfy your concept of imminent danger or imminent harm to the plaintiff that doesn't involve a child that is already in the process of being transitioned without the parent's knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, I think it becomes very hard to think about imminent as opposed to actual in this case. And I think that's because you have to start with a child who's going to run away. Now, one of these children in these cases, one of the children of one of the parents did run away before. And so there's probably some increased likelihood there that we could think, okay, maybe there's more of a likelihood that would happen again. But again, whether or not it's finding emails or text messages saying, I know what I'm going to do next, I'm going to run away, and here's the shelter where I'm going to go to so I can get away from my parents. Again, that's maybe not a record you're going to find very often, but if we're thinking about imminent as opposed to actual, I mean, in some cases, those are the kinds of records that we're talking about. Again, imminent, or if you want to come back to Clapper, certainly impending, right? It'd be very hard in Clapper for these U.S. citizens to be able to demonstrate that there's someone who's going to a FISA court to get a warrant to come listen and tap into their phones if we're thinking about what's that certainly impending harm that's going to arise to them. But again, sometimes in these standing cases, just because the imminent harm is hard, and sometimes it does require waiting for the actual harm to arise in these cases. And again, not an ideal situation to be those parents who are in that situation, right, where the harm has actually arisen, where a child has run away and they've been denied access in those cases. And maybe it's a reason why in certain cases the standing requirements have been relaxed in a number of other contexts. And So I think if we're looking for imminent, we would want that kind of text record of the kinds of activity for the child, plus maybe some more of the guidance from the state about, if this person or this child is running away from the parents, that's a pretty strong demonstration that they suggest they're evading the parents and they want to be able to escape parental oversight, which would then suggest that the state is going to find it much more likely that they're going to detain them or to hold on to them without releasing the information to the parents. But I admit it's not an unfair question. It just results in maybe a hard answer.
Well, and Sean, my question for you is, of course, we have pre-Dobbs, this significant body of jurisprudence from the Supreme Court in the abortion context. And post-Dobbs, we have the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine case, which Washington relies extensively on. But the pre-Dobbs regime set up under the Akron case, the city of Akron cases, a process by which not only could a minor as young as 12 or 13 who is pregnant go into a court and have a secret proceeding where their parents weren't notified, weren't given the opportunity to be heard, et cetera, and that the court would then give the minor the capacity or endow the minor with the capacity to consent to the abortion. And then the girl's sent home to the parents who have no knowledge of what's happening. Now, the Texas Supreme Court was asked to post-Dobbs eliminate those sorts of proceedings because of the violation of procedural due process of parents' rights. They declined to do so, but a Florida intermediate appellate court just a couple of months ago said that those sorts of secret proceedings did violate procedural due process. It was dicta because there were other bases that the opinion relied on. But what do you make of that sort of precedent? It's not cited. Well, the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine case is cited by the parties, but it won't be the first time the courts allowed secret procedures to be performed on minors.
Well, I think there's a prime distinction to draw in the Akron cases, and later you were talking about courts who were operating under the directive of Roe and later cases that held that obtaining an abortion is a constitutional right. Here, you're talking about a state legislature, which, from the petitioner's view, has enacted a law that undermines a constitutional right. And so it would seem to me that any justification for the Akron-style secret tribunals for underage girls has no place when you're talking about a legislature's attempt not to further a constitutional right, but to undermine it.
So one of the cases that the state of Washington relies on is the Fifth Circuit case of DeAnda versus Bersera. And there, the Fifth Circuit held that because there was a statutory right of parents to direct the medical care of their children or to be informed when a young girl obtained contraception, that the conflict with federal law, that the state statutory right prevailed. Is that the only remedy if cert isn't granted in this case, is for Washington parents to get a state statutory right of parental rights legislation passed?
Really difficult to think about because of the political setting here. Let's just consider that for a moment. The Washington legislature enacted a law which is, in my view, quite inconsistent with recent case law from the Supreme Court. For a reason, because its political will is pointing in the opposite direction. And so even moderate local relief, say a municipal ordinance and so on, seems pretty much out of reach when parents who object to their child's transitioning are in a distinct minority in that state.
Given that, if I can ask you both, handicap the conference that's coming up later this week for me. Whoever wants to go first.
I'll let Derek take it first this time.
Well, again, I mean, first off, there have already been three votes to grant. So I think the question is if there's a fourth. I do think Sean is right to suggest that a case like Mirabelli would seem to enhance the likelihood that the court is interested in taking these kind of a case. At the same time, Mirabelli seems to rely much more on this sort of classroom context and thinking about what's happening when there are regulations of how children are being educated in the public schools, and the children are all subject to this policy, which is sort of known and defined and fixed. In a way that maybe the contingencies here aren't. And you add to the complexity, and I have great sympathy for thinking about how states deal with this, dealing with runaway children or dealing away with a foster system or dealing with those children who are suffering abuse and neglect. And how do we handle that sort of additional layer of state involvement in a very sensitive domain? Now, maybe that gets to the merits. I totally understand that. But when you're talking about these kinds of injuries that you're articulating, sometimes the merits questions and the messiness of the merits do leak into those questions on the standing side of things. So my instinct is to suggest, if there's only been three votes in the past, that there's going to continue to be three votes indefinitely, that I don't know that there's going to be a great appetite until the facts arise in a significantly different way. So if that's the case, my guess is maybe we'll see those three votes, three dissenting, and no more.
Sean?
Well, I am going to do the thing that I advise my young associates not to do, and that is to count heads based on multiple decisions. If you look at both the Eau Claire case that Derek has mentioned and then a later case, both of them involving Alito separate decisions, the Eau Claire, Wisconsin case involved a dissent. He thought that the court should have granted cert. In the other case, it was a concurrent agreeing that certiorari was inappropriate. But if you add up the votes in those two cases, what you have are the votes from Alito, Kavanaugh, Thomas, and Gorsuch. And in my mind, if this case gets a grant, those are the four that will vote for the grant. I think Justice Barrett, in her concurrence, noted in passing that one of the reasons why the emergency application relief was appropriate was because the district court had already held substantial proceedings on a summary judgment. And so, therefore, she was comfortable that this wasn't just sort of on a bare record the way that she will often object to, especially on the shadow docket. As for Chief Justice Roberts, we all know he's a minimalist. He's loved to avoid any of these big issues if he possibly can. Standing is an easy way to avoid this issue. But I think if those same four justices cast a vote in favor of a grant here, that's where the grant will come.
Can I follow up and ask you if you think he'll vote to find standing then?
On the merits, Chief Justice Roberts?
Yes.
He has not tended on most occasions. I come up with a couple of counterexamples, but he's not tended to be a standing hawk once the court actually hears the case. I think he would probably go along with the general tenor of Alito's remarks. I think it is just so hugely controversial that he'd like to keep the court out of the path of fire if he can.
Okay. We've got a question from a viewer right now. And so one of our viewers asked the question, Tim Davis, could legislative intent ever be relevant to the standing inquiry? Does it make harm more imminent or likely? Certainly, the briefing in the case talks a lot about legislative intent, but we have to remember Justice Scalia's famous observation about legislative intent, too. What do you think, Derek?
I mean, this is a little bit messy in the briefing here. That is, and again, I think this is why when we're thinking about facial versus as applied challenges, especially of state laws, there's a whole separate wing of federal court's jurisprudence in abstention doctrines. And the reason why, whether it's Pullman abstention or the notion that we're going to step back and let the state sort out its own affairs before we step in, you can have a pretty, shall we say, negative or hostile legislative environments. But at the same time, what comes out of that legislature is the legislation that has to be implemented in a particular way. And maybe when the executive, and we saw this in, I think, the one of those Colorado cases, 303 Creative or one of the others, where the executive or the executive actors do make those sort of overtly hostile statements in the course of enforcing the law, we tend to use those kinds of statements. But that's a little different than the legislative history side of things. And there's some suggestion, well, maybe we should look at the legislative history differently when it's a state rule as opposed to a federal rule. And that's one of the things that's appropriate for interpreting state rules in the state of Washington. And I think the petitioners make that claim in a footnote. But all that is to say, I think a lot more should matter on the text of the statute and then how the executive intends to enforce that statute and the sort of policy statements that go toward the implementation. And I do think the petitioners make points as to some of the executive interpretations and how Department of Child Welfare is supposed to be enforcing these rules to suggest that it's on their side. They say if Washington comes back to suggest it's on their side, I think that would be the more appropriate place. I think a little bit less on the legislative side, but there's certainly no question that Sean has some good legislative history on that front, especially to point at how the parents are being targeted in some respects. And if the court wants to take the Diamond case and really say, well, we're going to really run with it and say that the legislature intended this kind of targeting of parents, then maybe we'll have a new development of standing doctrine that will require the legislatures to be a little bit more careful. But I'm a little bit more skeptical that the court would go in that direction.
Sean, do you agree?
I come at the opposite point on the very narrow issue of whether the legislative history matters for the issue of whether these parents were objects of the law. Just that. I'm not talking about reading the statute as a whole, disregarding any of the text anyway, just the standing question of whether, notwithstanding they're never mentioned, is the class of all parents opposing their children's gender transitioning the object of this law? And I think the evidence from the legislative history is relevant to that question.
Okay. You both said that there's clearly a possibility of four votes to grant cert, but neither of you mentioned Justice Kagan's call in her concurring opinion in Mirabelli that the court needs to take up this issue in some way. And instead of doing this per curiam nonsense, let's take a case on the merits, like the Foote case, which they ultimately rejected. Could Kagan be the fourth vote instead of Roberts? What do you think?
I'm going to say no on that one. I think Justice Kagan, who's extremely bright, is looking for a merits case along the line of Foote. I think Foote had a vehicle problem that prevented it being that kind of case. But if you say saw Mirabelli in full dress on the merits coming out of the Ninth Circuit 2 years from now, she might well vote for review on that. Certainly would be consistent with what she said.
Eric?
I think if in a case like this, and presuming, and maybe I shouldn't presume, but I think I will, that Justice Kagan would be inclined to agree or affirm the Ninth Circuit, I think it would be a pretty big risk to grant cert only to have it reversed, right? So I think you would want to find a case where you could at least, you would hope for reversal if you are inclined to agree with the state. And realize there's really no harm if you end up affirming because it's going to preserve the status quo. Although obviously there would be precedent that would extend throughout the country. So my instinct is to say that no, she would not do it, which is not to say that it's inconsistent with her views in Mirabelli to say we need to grant these things on cert, just that suddenly different factors come into play when actually presented with whether or not to grant cert.
Fair enough. Our final question comes from John Scheller, who asks, what do you two make of the fact that they've conferenced and then reset for conference and then reset for conference? Now, of course, at one point, the state of Washington said, we don't even need to answer this. They lost at the trial court. They lost at the intermediate court. We're not going to bother. And then the court came back and said, oh, yes, you are. What do you make of that delay? Sean?
As a matter of sort of standard practice, resetting a case for conference generally indicates someone on the court is interested. And the more times that it's reset up to a point, there's sort of a continuum here. But I'm looking at, you know, like the Foote case, which seriously, I think it was like in double digits by the time the court finally issued a denial. But within a range, you know, if you have like 3, 4, 5, reschedulings of that conference, it does tend to indicate that someone on the court is taking the case seriously. They perhaps are asking for more details from the cert memo, you know, what have you, in order to decide whether or not they're going to get stuck with a dig. But absent that, the court's order for Washington to respond to the petition and the fact that it's gone through a couple of these rescheduled conferences is, for the petitioners, probably good news.
Derek?
Yeah, I mean, I'll only add, I tend to agree with Sean. There is this complexity, again, the West Virginia case that the court is considering, whether, and again, I know it's a different issue, but the notion of children or parents and transgender issues, there is this sort of umbrella universe of these cases. And while there are going to be doctrinal differences, there's also some interest perhaps in the court waiting and then deciding, as it sometimes does, of just grant, vacate, remand, and try to decide on these kinds of issues later on, punt on the issue. Maybe it doesn't really work in the standing context here. The court doesn't have any more big standing cases on its docket the rest of this term. But that would be the small addition, probably an unlikely contingency that it's waiting for. But I think Sean has it right.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Riley?
I want to thank all of our panelists for sharing your expertise and opinions on this important issue. And thank you, Professor Collette, for moderating. If our audience is interested in learning more about all of the Federalist Society's programming, please visit their website at fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.